With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Eureka, the show that gets under the skin of science as we invite a new expert every week to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
And this guy is such an accomplished doctor. He has looked over thousands of pieces of research for today's episode and is actually doing so right now.
Have I?
Yes, unwittingly.
Oh, that's my favourite kind of research.
Yes, the easiest. Because the topic that we're sticking our beaks into today is thought to be the oldest sense in any living creature. Smell.
Smell.
And as you know, this is one...
this is great for you.
It's like, honestly, though, I found this doubly fascinating because if you don't know, I have quite a poor sense of smell. Although... over the years, it has recovered. So when I was, I guess, 14, I sniffed pure ammonia, which is a very, very powerful alkali.
In a school science experiment, was it?
Well, in a school science lesson, when I wasn't really listening, the guy said something about ammonium smelling salts. Very different, actually, to pure ammonia. And I had a cold. And I was like, yeah, I'll have a go on that. And it was excruciatingly painful, but also definitely, damaged some of my... the inner workings of my nose. So slowly with time, I think my sense of smell has got better, but it's definitely not at the level of most people. So I find it sort of, particularly fascinating.
I mean, I don't have a great sense of smell, I don't think, because quite often I'll be in a room and somebody say, oh, can you smell that? And I'm like, no. And then...
But then have a sniff and you'll be able to get it.
Yeah, you sort of have to deliberately sniff and then pretend you've got it because you don't want to feel left out.
Yeah. Well, I've obviously done a lot of that in my life. But I now find that if someone says, oh, can you smell that? And then I actively kind of, then I will get it.
Yeah, and you have to think about it, don't you?
But I'm not getting a lot of ambient stuff.
No.
I think is quite a good system.
I don't get subtleties, definitely. So like smelling like elderflower.
Well, that's sort of generally as well. For all five of your senses.
don't do subtlety.
Well, you're like, a sledgehammer guy, really.
Yeah, it's taste. I mean, it's definitely, so I know taste and smell are sort of linked together, but I definitely
We'll get into that, don't you worry.
I'm sure we will. I definitely have very refined palate in terms of taste and really, you know, quite a basic bitch in terms of smell, I suspect, as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. Have you got a favourite smell?
I mean, it's corny, but fresh cut grass always does it for me.
Because it
reminds me of when I was like 6 or 7 years old, we used to live opposite a park and, you know, they used to cut the grass. We used to go out there, roll it all up and like dive into it and, you know, make jumping hedges for space hoppers, things like that.
Yeah.
So it's associated with a great deal of joy for me.
Strong emotional connection.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's quite typical. Worst smell?
Raffi's breath, probably.
Is that your wife?
Oh, yeah, actually.
Yeah, a dog's breath is never, ideal, is it?
No.
I think I don't know if I've got a favourite smell. It might just be as simple as there's some sort of body moisturiser that Ema uses that's nice.
Yeah.
It smells a sort of mandarin, I think it is. Mandarin and something. Mandarin.
You got that from the label on the bottle, didn't you?
Vanilla. It's quite sweet. And it almost feels like it tastes nice. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I imagine it doesn't, actually.
No, it probably doesn't.
You should try licking it, though.
I don't think I will. I think you might find that a bit weird. I don't know if I've got a worse smell, really. I do.
Ammonia, presumably.
I don't recall what that smelt like. I do recall the pain, which was significant.
I'd love to actually just reintroduce you to a bit of ammonia and see if you have any kind of reaction to it.
You know, a sort of Pavlovian response. Yeah. It's like, it was extraordinary. It was so dumb. Anyway, entirely self-inflicted. But I think the work I did, don't want to post too much here, but of course I did a show called Fatberg Autopsy for Channel 4 a few years ago. And partly, well, the main gist of it was dragging a Fatberg out of a sewer and then analysing its chemical contents. It was fine.
Did it win BAFTAs?
No, but it got quite good reviews. It actually wasn't that bad.
No, I saw it. It was all right, actually.
Yeah, it was okay, wasn't it? Yeah. And there's a bit, I don't know if you remember, where I actually go down into a sewer with a sewer guy. And he says to me, oh, this is, you know, the stench down here is, like, it is bad. I mean, I'm sort of used to it, but it is bad. And I said to him, not a problem, because I don't really have a very good sense of smell, so I'm actually the perfect person for this. And we went down, and there's like a crust, I suppose, over the over the contents of the sewer. And he said, yeah, you just break through that. So I put my boot through it, and the malodor that emerged was, I mean, unforgivable. And I thought I was just immediately going to vomit.
Yeah.
I was retching. I think this is all on camera, and they obviously found it hilarious. but it was just, I can't really put it into words. It was so bad. And I was, just retching away and just thinking, don't vomit on camera, don't vomit on camera. Even though it's good telly, don't vomit on camera, because that'll follow you around. Yeah.
We all have those scents that have the power to take us back in time. Freshly cut grass, baking bread, maybe the smell of petrol, or newly washed bedsheets. But what determines what we like? And is there one scent that reigns supreme? That's why today we're asking, is there a perfect scent?
As ever, we have recruited an expert to help us answer today's question, because it was never going to be me, to be honest, or you. Today, we'll be speaking with Professor Charles Spence, who is the head of the Crossmodal Research Laboratory at Oxford University. So he's a psychologist who's interested in the senses and the interplay of the senses. And I was particularly interested to speak to Charles because I think we undervalue how important smell is. And he's recently come up with a book called Sense Hacking, which is all about the power of scent to affect our social, cognitive and emotional well-being. He's the ideal man for this job.
Okay, so what was the first question you asked him?
I asked him whether scent was important for well-being.
Smell is very important for well-being. You know, if you lose your sense of smell, then you're increased risk of suicide. It's been suggested that Michael Hutchins, of in excess, he got into a street fight, hit his head on the pavement, lost his sense of smell, and killed himself not long thereafter. So certainly on the downside, if you lose it, the emotional negative consequences are really bad. On the plus side, I think it can be very useful to improve our moods. I know I could prove in an experiment that if I could add the scent of fresh mown grass to the next World Cup, you would say the games were just that much better, more enjoyable, more engaging, more immersive. I could prove that scientifically, but then if I asked you why did you enjoy the game so much, you'd say it's just a great game of football. What I call a sort of fundamental misattribution error, that we will not attribute our pleasures to smell. And in one of my favourite studies of some patients in hospital who were, you know, not sleeping very well, they'd been on sleeping tablets for 2 years or more each. And that can put you to sleep, but it doesn't give you the right kind of sleep. And then in a study, they took them off the sleeping tablets and then put them on lavender-scented ward instead. And they actually slept better and longer with the lavender scent than with the sleeping tablets.
All right, so I'm quite into the idea of getting the smell of fresh cut grass.
Of course you are.
Match.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that would do it all for me, I would say.
I mean, quite often I feel like it might be there anyway, because they've mowed the
lawn. They've just mowed the grass. Well, yeah. I don't know. I mean,
not sure they call it a lawn, do they?
Also, you're not close enough to it, are you, really? So they need to pipe it through the stadium, basically, wherever you are.
The thing with this is, I have spent a very enjoyable, and for various reasons, I've had longer than normal to prepare for this episode.
Right.
We don't need to go into the vagaries of our scheduling, but that is what's happened. And in some ways, that's good news. It's bad news for you, because I've done loads of research. And I found it absolutely fascinating. And I honestly don't really know where to start. But I think possibly the best place is just to say that smell has been basically ignored by science for a really long time. And people just didn't think it was important. And so there's a whole sort of range of scientific luminaries through the ages who have disrespected smell and basically said, yeah. So Darwin said it provides an extremely slight service to humans.
No,
it's not important to humans. Immanuel Kant said it's the most dispensable and ungrateful sense.
Oh, that's interesting.
No interest. People have called it a kind of brutish sensation. And there's this kind of idea that animals rely on, other animals rely on scent and kind of sniff each other's asses and stuff. But we've kind of graduated beyond that.
So we've evolved beyond the point where it doesn't really matter to us.
So even to the point when there was books about human physiology that didn't have like medical books that just didn't have chapters on smell because people are like, well, that doesn't really, we could just leave
but
that
I mean
alone.
You can, I guess what they're saying is you can live without it and you can live perfectly adequately, so
right.
It's like the icing on the cake, really, in some ways, isn't it, smell for us? I mean, obviously there's some warnings, like you smell some food and you think okay, that's off, I won't eat that.
But if you think about the sort of the fundamental nature of smell, because what smell is doing is it's telling you about your immediate chemical environment.
Yeah.
And so if you go right back into, the evolutionary tree and the path. So when life first emerged, the first thing that it would have learned to do really is smell, or have some sort of sense that was like smell, detecting its chemical environment, knowing whether to move towards something, away from something, what it needed more of, what it needed less of. And that is all effectively, that's part of the chemosensory system, which is smell, taste, and then this weird thing called the trigeminal system.
Oh, tell me more.
So they're as you said, they're related. The trigeminal system tells you things like the spice from pepper, the kind of the fresh coolness of mint, like the bubbles in a fizzy drink. That's the trigeminal system that's doing that. Taste, as you probably know, is doing just... Well, we used to think it was just five, actually. So we used to think it was sweet, sour, salty, umami...
Bitter.
And now we've realised that there's a fat one as well.
Oh, is
it? So it's actually doing... It's doing six. But everything else, so all of the kind of the detail, the fine detail of flavour comes from smell.
Yeah.
So... For example, if you didn't have a sense of smell at all, Sprite and Coke would taste exactly the same to you.
No.
Yeah, you just wouldn't be able to tell. And what happens with, not so much with liquids where it's just evaporation, but with foods, when you chew, it just kind of releases volatile material and it goes up into your up into your nose and you smell it, and that's what informs.
And then you think that's taste.
Yeah, but they're so closely related that it's sort of... It's not an artificial distinction. It's just a part of the same package, same, this chemosensory system is detecting your environment.
It's literally just, it comes from over there, a molecule comes off it, you interpret what that molecule is, and you know something about that thing that's over there, and that's kind of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, to be honest, that's pretty much how people were happy to leave it for quite a long
time. That's science done.
Yeah. So we think it's just, it goes in your nose and your brain says, oh, yeah, I recognise that.
Yeah.
But people were, for a long time, thinking, oh, it must work in a similar way to vision. It must be like, so we have rods and cones in our eyes, four different types, and they produce, that's enough. Like we can make everything we see with that.
Yeah.
And so people thought, oh, there's probably something like primary colours, but for smells.
Yeah.
And that's not true. So do you know how many different types of smell receptors there are in your nose?
There's hundreds.
Yeah, 400. 400. Okay. And then millions of them, but 400 different types of receptor.
Yeah.
And so then you start thinking, okay. So the combinations that you can, it's not just going to be like 400 factorial.
No.
Because it's also going to be measuring like the different intensities of them. So you then end up with a scenario where actually the range that you can smell is, I mean, it's not going to be infinite, but it's going to be a very, very large number.
Yeah.
So the thought of, well, maybe you can just come up with a list or a map of all of the smells, that feels all not quite intractable, but nearly intractable.
Really? Well, you can't just you can't just create a massive spreadsheet of this means this and this does this. And if these two receptors fire or these three receptors fire, then
people are sort of working in odour space and trying to create sort of new smells that have never been found on Earth before, certainly. And the idea is that your nose would still be able to smell them.
Yeah.
Even though it's never come across them before.
You just have to develop a new language for them.
Well, and that is actually one of the key differences, that's one of the many differences between vision and smell, is that certainly in Western languages, if you think about how often we use sort of visual metaphors to talk about stuff, and how much language we have and vocabulary we have available to describe things visually, versus how much we have to describe smells, like it's chalk and cheese. Like we just don't have the words. We don't have the ways to describe smells.
So when a wine expert says, "Oh, that's got a really sort of woody aroma," is it not really woody? Is that just a word that they use for for a particular chemical?
So this is kind of fascinating because when you watch wine tasters or you hear wine tasters, you think, well, obviously you're full of shit. It turns out they're not. So what they've done is they have created a language that works to describe smells. But more than that, when they're saying, oh yeah, I'm getting the a bit of the like fresh tennis balls, when you just opened a carton of fresh tennis balls, and you just think, well, of course you haven't. But it's quite possible they have, or certainly very similar molecules that would be emitted by the tennis balls coming off this wine as well. And what they've got is they've just got a huge sort of set of benchmarks, sort of reference smells that they can refer to that we, you know, people who haven't done that don't have. But genuinely, if they're saying, oh, this one's quite sort of leathery, then the molecules that they're getting in their nose there are probably the molecules that would be coming off some old leather. So they're not
really making
they're
it up,
actually
are they?
Not they're not making it up.
I'm glad to hear that because I know a couple of people who are quite, you know, big in the wine tasting world.
I like
to think that they know what they're doing.
That is genuinely surprising though, isn't it?
Yeah. But by the way, if you're listening, I didn't
like
think
charlatans.
You were a charlatan.
Yeah, you did, but everyone does. You watch it and think that's got to be a confidence thing. And obviously there's a lot of bravado in it as well.
Yeah. But it's literally a skill set I don't have, and a vocabulary I don't have, and an experience I don't have. So
you could train yourself.
I could train myself, yeah. I can't afford their fees, to be honest.
No, fine. But if money was no object, you could train yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you do sort of functional smell training, just doing it for 6 weeks, not only will you get better when you test yourself, but also you can literally see a specific part of your cortex getting thicker.
Wow.
In just 6 weeks.
That's incredible.
Mm.
I mean, I don't advise doing the self brain surgery thing, but
no.
A friend of mine is recovering from COVID and lost her sense of smell, and she's training her she'll often find her sniffing half a lemon.
Yeah, but
and she's retraining her senses, she says.
It's a really good idea. I mean, obviously smell research has spiked since COVID.
Yeah,
because
of course.
You've got all of
these
people suddenly becoming much more interested because when you speak to people who've lost their sense of smell through COVID, they talk about feeling like really freaking out and feeling like they're isolated and sort of disconnected from the world. And it just feels like everything's wrong and everything's a bit confusing. And loads of people saying this, and it starts to make you realise that actually smell is much more significant in our day-to-day lives. We're just not conscious of it, but if you take it away, we really feel it. And then there's this horrible thing that's happening, not to everyone, but to some people who've gone anosmic. When they recover from COVID, they end up with parosmia, and that's where you are detecting the smells okay, but then you're misinterpreting them.
Oh,
so you'll smell coffee and it'll smell like shit, like that sort of thing. and for some reason it seems
that's terrible.
It's bad smells that you end up with. So you're smelling something that previously, you know, like a rose or whatever it is.
And that's in the brain, not
like
in the
rotting
nose, presumably.
But they actually don't quite know. Fundamentally, we don't really understand how the brain identifies smells.
But presumably,
or
you've got
similarity to another.
The receptors
smell
in your nose haven't changed by COVID, but the interpretation. No, I don't know. Well, we don't know why you lose your sense of smell, do we?
No, no. That's
wow.
People aren't blocked up with it. That's the thing. It's not a sort of like, I've just got a really nasty cold and I'm just sort of, you know, snotty. Yeah. It's not that at all. So something is happening and genuinely people aren't quite sure what.
Wow.
And they don't know, you know, if it's almost, I suppose one way of picturing it is like an old school telephone exchange. If you suddenly just muddled up all of the wiring,
yeah.
It almost feels a bit like right. that. What the mechanic of that would be, it's not clear.
So when Dr. Charles is putting on the lavender aromatherapy for your night and all you can smell is shit.
Yeah, yeah. You're like, no,
no,
it's not working for me, I'm afraid, Charles.
Turn it off.
It's not working for me.
Let's take a quick break now, but we'll be back after this to discuss how businesses are using scents to make us buy more, how smell plays a role in attraction, and of course we'll be asking this week's expert, Professor Charles Spence, is there a perfect scent?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
And we're back. So to summarise and kind of bring that back to basics, what it seems like is that your olfactory receptors detect a molecule, or more typically a group of molecules, and then your brain is searching through some sort of database, not really sure what that looks like, and then tries to figure out where it's encountered it before.
Yeah.
Which makes some sense and does account for what you see with wine tasting, for example.
So that's why you get specific sort of memory associations as well, presumably.
Yes. Yeah.
So, but when we get that that sort of, you know, here's a smell, and this is what it kind of basically sort of makes me feel like.
Mm.
So does it mean we've learned some kind of association, or
that's a good question.
Is it actually sort of, you know, pressing a button in our brain that makes us feel this way when we smell this smell, or is it just to do with some kind of, you know, learned association?
So I actually asked Charles about this and asked him whether aromatherapy scents like lavender, for example, which are used a great deal and have been used for years and years, sort of seem to have calming properties, whether that is having a sort of direct physiological influence on us, or if it's just a kind of subconsciously learned reaction.
Yeah.
There may be a few of these aromatherapy scents that actually do have like a direct physiological influence on us over and above what we learn. So we certainly learn that lavender's, you know, what we smell when we go to bed, and that helps. There was a recent study showing that even rats slept better with the smell of lavender, something like that. And you think, how can that be on mice? I think they had to, you know, had a much bigger dose of lavender than we might use to scent our bed sheets, but nevertheless sort of suggesting that there might be this, sometimes these direct physiological consequences of certain scents. But the other one I often refer to is heliotropin flower, which is the smell of Johnson & Johnson's baby powder. And again, when I sort of sprinkle that around people as adults, they sort of can find it pleasant, sort of familiar, but they can't put a name to it, with it unless it's got the packaging with it out of context. And you think, well, that must be a learnt thing, that somewhere in our deep unconscious, we remember our earliest experiences of being pampered and powdered and put to bed, and hence that one is probably a bit more learnt.
So let's talk a bit about lavender, because Charles seems to want to talk a lot about lavender.
Or is it because today's episode is brought to you by the Lavender Marketing Board?
Lavender. So lavender has been, as I said, it's been used for a long time for like scenting bed sheets and stuff.
Yeah.
And in fact, the name lavender comes from lavandera, which means, have I got that right? I think I have, which means laundress in Spanish.
Yeah.
So, and the laundress would use lavender to scent the bed sheets. And it has long been thought to have a kind of sedative or calming effect. There's not been a lot of scientific or clinical research done into it. But you have to say that, you know, people have been, I mean, in literature, it's been referred to since the kind of 17th century, and you assume it's been used for much longer than that. There probably is something in it.
Yeah, almost certainly.
The studies that have been done so far, not wildly conclusive. And the thing that really complicates it is that smell, entirely unlike vision, is context dependent and context adaptive. So if you think about vision, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, your vision is working in the same way.
Right.
Like you might sort of slightly turn down the brightness, I suppose you might squint, but not really. It just worked like that. So it doesn't react to context, and certainly doesn't adapt to context.
No.
So like living in a certain place isn't going to make your vision sort of demonstrably different.
Yeah.
Whereas smell absolutely does. So different smells will be interpreted differently according to context, and you will adapt to your sort of chemical smell environment. So there's loads of smells that you'll just be so used to that you don't really notice them. So like the smell of your house.
For
example, your house will have quite a specific smell. You very rarely will be aware of it.
Yeah.
Sometimes if you've been away for a while and you walk back in, you might get hit by it when you first walk in. But effectively, you filter all that stuff out.
Yeah, like living in somewhere that's damp, for instance. Decades ago, I was living in a place that was damp, and you just stop smelling after a while, and then you go away for a weekend or you go away for a week and you come back and you're like, oh my God, this is appalling.
Yeah, yeah. But I find that fascinating because it just doesn't happen with any of your other senses. So yeah, the fact that it's kind of, so you, and immediately that tells you can't have, that's why the sort of the smell map, the kind of that you might want to.
Yeah, it's like a shapeshifter.
It is absolutely a shapeshifter.
Yeah.
And so there's a classic experiment actually where you get two vials, one marked Parmesan and one marked vomit.
Oh yeah.
And you get people to smell them, and people, almost everyone, expresses a preference for the Parmesan.
Yeah.
The mixture in the vials is exactly the same, and it's a compound that is found in both parmesan and vomit. So it smells the same, but it does also smell yeah. both of parmesan and vomit. But because of the, because you're giving people the context, people will go yeah. for will go for the parmesan. But it's not an error. People aren't making an error. That is just how yeah. smell works. Because people will sometimes point to that experiment and say, "Oh, that's a proof that smell is just entirely subjective."
But no, it's not. But, I mean, you're smelling the right chemical, aren't you?
Yeah. Totally.
You don't know where to file it.
Yeah, no, but context tells you. And so your sense of smell figures that out. It's trying to figure out what does this signal mean given the context?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it does. And that kind of contextual evaluation that is all going on sort of without you really being aware of it is fascinating and unique in the senses. There's just weird stuff, like there's some chemicals where the intensity of the smell will change what you interpret the smell as entirely. So there's a compound where if you have a low concentration in a vial, you'll sniff it and you'll think, oh, it's grapefruit. And if you have a high concentration of it, exactly the same compound, it will smell like rotten eggs.
No.
Yeah. It's great. Or I've got loads of these. Actually.
I want to try this at home.
I know. You kind of do, don't you? So fresh cucumbers smell almost identical to fresh oysters.
Oh.
Which is a weird
one. Okay. You can try that one at home.
You can try that one at home if you'd like to. How familiar are you with optical isomers?
Oh, I am a little bit.
Yeah. So it's a kind of, it's a quirky little thing that chemists get hard on for mainly, and it's when you have molecules that are absolutely identical, so all of the functional groups in exactly the same place, but they're mirror images.
Yeah.
And people study these, and they're quite interesting. They're called, there's another word for them,
enantiomers.
Yeah. This I cannot get my head around this, but there's a molecule that in the left hand version, I think it is. I might have this wrong around. Doesn't matter. In the left hand version of the molecule, it smells of mint,
right.
And the right-hand version of the molecule smells of caraway. Totally different. But all of the functional all the functional groups are the same.
So when it goes into your nose, effectively the handedness of the molecule makes an enormous difference.
Yeah, it's a totally different smell.
So it's like
smell.
If it was a corkscrew, or it'd be like right-twisting and left-twisting.
Yeah.
It sort of won't fit into the same receptor. I know that's not how it works, but that kind of
something. Yeah, it's not
ridiculous.
Quite lock and key, but it's something.
Yeah.
It's something like that.
Yeah.
But that's mad, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is mad because it's not just about what atoms are there. It's about how they're arranged in such an intricate way. That's incredible.
Yeah. Also, at this point, it's worth saying that the previous kind of thought amongst everyone, really, and I know I say previous, but I think people still hold it, is that humans not only don't really need smell anymore because we're above it, we're not very good at it, we don't have a good sense of smell. And so there was a scientist about 150 years ago who looked at our olfactory bulb and said, well, that's small, so it must be bad. And everyone just sort of went, yeah, that's probably true. But in fairness, when you look at the number of neurons in there and you compare it to other mammals, we're right sort of slap bang in the middle. It's not it's not much better or worse than the average mammal. And also, we can do some amazing things. We just don't realize it. So we can tell the difference between two types of sweat. So someone who's been exercising and someone who's scared. We do a thing, and now I've become obsessed with trying to work out whether I am doing it, although it's hard because thinking about it is influencing it. But apparently, when you shake someone's hand, quite soon after, you sniff your hand. Involuntarily, it's like a thing that you do to get a sense of the person.
You do not.
Because you can tell, you've got loads of information about the person from their odour.
And so you've been thinking about this. Do you do it?
Well, no, I haven't, but it's because I'm thinking about it. Do you know what I mean? I'm messing with
you're
the system.
You're stopping yourself, aren't you?
I am stopping myself, because every time I think, I'm not doing it, it's weird.
But
I think if I wasn't thinking about it, I would be doing it, because apparently that is what we do.
Oh, I've got to watch people doing this now.
Yeah, that's the thing. You need to watch people.
Yeah.
Also, you think, dogs are amazing. They can follow a scent.
Yeah.
Someone did an experiment about 15 years ago and got blindfolded humans and gotten to sniff through grass, and we can also do it. We don't. And we're not as, in fairness, we're not as good at, no. as dogs at it, but we can do it. We can follow a scent.
Right.
Which again,
I know what I'm doing tonight.
Yeah, yeah. Shaking hands and sniffing around the grass. Out with Raffy. and then there's quite a famous experiment where you give someone's T-shirt and you can sniff it and you can work out whether that person, I mean, again, not really consciously, so it's all weird, but whether that person has an immune system that is similar to yours or different to yours,
and
if it's different, you find that person more attractive, and that's really powerful.
Yeah.
Because a different immune system means
you want to combine,
that'll be like a super immune system if you procreate.
Wasn't kissing meant to be evolved basically as a way of sniffing?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Yeah. And some people are like particularly amazing at it. So there's a nurse called Joyce Milne who could smell people and tell whether they have Parkinson's disease.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, but they tested it. And people are trying to develop sort of electronic noses now.
Yeah, yeah.
That would allow you to do that. Because, like, and dogs can be trained to smell cancer.
Yes, yeah, I have read that, yeah.
Because effectively, what's happening is your metabolism is in some way getting fucked with.
Right.
And then it's producing some unusual products.
What was that nurse sniffing? Was it, like, breath or skin?
I actually don't know. I imagine it's sweat. Imagine it's sweat, but it could be breath. I mean, it's metabolic byproducts is what you're trying to sniff. Yeah. And I think that either sweat or breath would probably do it, wouldn't it?
I mean, you could try that as a pickup line at a nightclub.
Yeah. Let me just check if you've... I know you're shaking over there.
Can I just check your metabolic byproducts?
but if you think about these, there's going to be some molecules that you're emitting that are kind of mistakes, and if you can find what the signature or a signature molecule from a given illness, then you could fairly easily come up with a device that would just detect that molecule and give you potentially quite an early warning system for a disease. And so people are really looking into that, and it seems quite promising.
Yeah,
and people have tried to work out sort of how good our sense of smell is. And so they've looked for this thing called a just noticeable difference. So effectively, you're seeing how much the chemicals need to differ in order to be told apart by humans.
Right.
And the short answer is, it is almost impossible to come up with two sort of multi-component odorants that humans can't discriminate between.
Really?
So the smallest tweak at an atomic level,
and people will
be like,
it.
People will be like, "No, that's not. No, you've changed that."
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, it's really good.
We're great at smelling.
Well, I'm personally not, but people generally are amazing at it.
Yeah,
yeah, and use it way more than we would ever have imagined. Yeah.
All right. Given that we are discovering that smell matters to us, and we're actually quite good at it, I imagine that people have started to monetize this now.
You imagine correctly, and I asked Charles about it.
There has been a huge growth in scent marketing. More companies doing it, more companies also providing the scent technology. So it's not just a bunch of flowers or an incense burner or something. Now there are sort of machines that you can buy or hire to put behind the counter that will pump out the smells. And the last time I went on a store visit with a client down Regent Street in London, and it's kind of like every store, from jeans to handbags to, they all had a scent. And that could be dangerous in as much as we don't normally think about smell, except maybe if we go past a Lush store and then you can't think about anything else. But normally we don't think about it too much. It sort of passes under our consciousness. And if it's affecting us, making us buy more, and this is what the sensory marketing firms and those selling those machines claim, I think the effects aren't necessarily always as big as the marketeers would have us believe. When the scientists, who aren't necessarily supported by industry, do the studies, the effects tend to be smaller.
Huge surprise. I would never have guessed that the scientists were being paid by the guys to be like, yeah, I think it works. But it does, it does seem to have some small effect. And one that we are not conscious of.
So we can be manipulated through smell.
Yeah, yeah. So if you think about what you're trying to achieve with that, so if the primary sort of aspect of the product isn't smell, so you're not selling a perfume, then what you're trying to do is get consumers to sort of just generally give a more positive evaluation to their experience in your
put them in a good mood in your store. Effectively.
Yeah, you want them to maybe spend more time in there. You want them to revisit more, and all of this obviously in order to try and get them to spend more money.
Yeah,
and it seems like it is possible to have a small effect, which is why when you step into, as Charles was saying, step into all manner of shops now, you may well notice that there is a kind of signature odour.
Yeah.
And someone will have been paid a lot of money to develop that.
Oh, that's nice. I mean, bakeries do it. I mean, supermarkets, don't they? With bakery smells and coffee smells. Then it's part of the reason why they have cafes in there now, to get pulls people in, because everyone likes those familiar smells.
How many molecules do you think are responsible for the smell of coffee?
I think it's just one. No? No,
of course it isn't. Are you going one?
No, I'm not going one. I'm going to go 127.
800.
800?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I like that.
I like
good
it.
Good stat.
The Louvre, the art gallery, commissioned a load of top perfumers to come up with scents for 8 of its works.
Right.
And they're trying to do something slightly different. They're actually trying to enhance people's experience.
Yeah.
But in a way that people hadn't really thought to do it before. Don't know if that has worked. That was quite recent that they commissioned that.
I mean, it's money for old rope in a way, isn't it? You just put a bit of sandalwood down there, you're basically laughing.
Is this just oud? Yeah, it is. It is just oud. It's quite lazy. Is that lavender? Is that lavender with the Mona Lisa?
All right, so we're learning stuff and the businesses are exploiting it.
Yeah.
But can we exploit it for ourselves? Like, you know, is there something I can do to enhance my life, apart from obviously lavender when I go to sleep, that, you know, that we've learned from science effectively?
Yeah, it's quite selfish, but yeah, predictable. But I was wondering too, so I asked Charles.
Taking the insights from the commercial sphere and saying this is what they're doing to us with music and scent and lights, so why don't we take that knowledge and use it for our own benefit and well-being. And that could be everything from scenting your home. And for those of us who are, you know, doing all these Zoom meetings and Zoom fatigue and thing and stuff is a thing these days, then simply by changing the scent in whichever room in the house you use for your office, that can like trigger an olfactory reset that will sort of take the stress away. Because if we're in a stressful meeting, we associate the smells of the space. So a bit like, you know, when you go to the dentist and you smell the eugenol, that kind of clove scent, and you start sweating and panicking, that's not a bad smell by itself, it's just what we associate with it. And if you change the smell of the dentists to orange, suddenly people are a lot less stressed than they were before.
Olfactory reset, I quite like that.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
It's really good.
Yeah, he's definitely used that before.
Yeah. And I'll be using it in future. So I know we're sort of working towards the idea of what is the perfect smell, but it's obvious to me now that like there is no perfect smell. It's like a perfect for a certain situation. So if I wanted to attract a member of the opposite sex, then...
Big if.
Yeah, it is a huge if, to be honest. But imagine that I did, rather than, as I tend to do, just trying to repel them all the time.
Yeah, you've had success with that already. That's done.
What would be the smell I would go for?
Well, I've actually asked Charles that as well.
It's not just what people look like or what they sound like, but it's also what you think they smell like or the smell when you see them. And that can affect judgments of attraction, certainly. And we did some fun research with Lynx, one of the, you know, sort of the young boys' deodorant brand. And that's always premised on the sort of strap line of a spray, bend and bonk. The ultimate attractant, at least for young girls of young boys, but they never actually tested it. And we did experiments in the lab here in Oxford in the brain scanner, having young women rate the attractiveness of pictures of men. And then we just sometimes pumped in the smell of Lynx, sometimes the smell of flowers, sometimes the smell of body odour, and sometimes the smell of sort of burnt rubber. Don't see what happened. And people's judgments of the attractiveness of those faces were actually modulated by about 10% more attractive by putting Lynx, yes, but in fact it was really any pleasant scent compared to, you know, the bad smells of body odour, which is probably what a young boy might otherwise smell like, or burnt rubber, which is going to be a bad smell but not really related to a person.
I mean, Lynx would be sort of happy with the results there, but also he's basically saying any sort of nice, in quotation marks, smell we'll do it.
Yeah.
Doesn't need
yeah.
to be links.
No, okay.
Just as long as it's not, yeah, sewage.
Lavender?
Yeah, lavender obviously will do it. I mean, I didn't love the phrase spray, bend and bonk. I mean, mainly because I don't quite... Maybe I do know where the bend comes in, but I just don't think the bend needs
no,
to be there.
No, it doesn't.
Spray and bonk feels enough. Spray, bend,
I mean,
and bonk.
No, there's a better phrase somewhere, isn't there?
Spray and lay. I'm calling Charles back. Spray and lay. Stop saying spray, bend, and bonk. It's spray and lay.
Spray and lay.
I'm pleased with that, actually.
Yeah.
That's good.
Have you sprayed? You won't get laid.
It's all coming together, isn't it?
Oh. I'm weird. We're open for offers, by the way.
It's sponsored by Lynx Java. You'll know why.
I just hope they don't send us a big crate of it.
But I think this sort of what this comes on to is something I think is really important is what is it about fragrances that makes us like them? So is it innate in some way? Like, are there kind of universal principles whereby humans like some fragrances and dislike some others? Or is it cultural?
Right.
Which feels quite plausible.
Yeah.
Or is it personal taste? But those feel like the sort of the three contenders, and it's probably going to be a mixture of
the three. It must be a mix of the three. I mean, certainly the cultural thing, because don't we all smell like milk to people from East Asia?
Yeah.
Because they don't drink milk, so they don't have that kind of natural, you know, metabolic byproduct
yeah.
sort of going on. So we smell sort of odd to them, but you know, none of us would smell each other and say, you smell of milk. So we're
no.
just... I mean, that's interesting. I wonder if that's changed with like the fact that people aren't drinking cow's milk anymore.
Maybe.
Maybe we smell less milky than we used to.
Well, that'd be a touch. Don't know. Yeah,
I don't like the idea of smelling milky.
But I mean, there's clearly going to be cultural stuff where... So actually, the Johnson's baby powder
is
an interesting example that Charles gave, where if you haven't used Johnson's baby powder or if it's not used in your country, then you may not have any particular association with it.
Yeah.
Other than, I suppose that you're probably, whatever the flower was... Maybe that is a nice smell anyway.
I don't know.
But actually, lemon is quite good. So citrusy lemon smell in certain places and sort of in the West mainly, but not exclusively, you'd associate that with cleanliness and freshness and cleaning products and stuff.
Lemon fresh.
But if you come from a place where there's loads of sort of lemon groves, then you might associate it with kind of rotting citrus fruit.
Ooh.
So you'd have a very different association with it. So it feels like culture would have a really big influence.
Yeah.
But no one had really done a proper study, because all of the studies were done with people who were sort of growing up in the same countries.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then you've got the culture is effectively the same, so you can't really strip away stuff. So someone did a study with 9 different groups of people from really diverse settings. So urban dwellers to literally to sort of indigenous hunter-gatherers to horticulturalists, people who in very different chemical environments.
Yeah.
And then they got them to rank, I think it was 10 different, like simple monomolecular odours, just because for it's just a bit more straightforward. Yeah. And just rank them from best to worst.
Yeah.
And the results are really fascinating. So only, well, have a guess, like in percentage terms, how much of the difference was accounted for by culture?
If they're monomolecular, they're going to be fairly sort of natural smells. So I think maybe 20%?
6%.
Yeah.
Really low. Yeah. And then quite a lot. So 54% just personal taste.
Right.
And then the rest, 40%, just universal principles. So actually, your likes and dislikes when it comes to smell are quite constrained.
Yeah, because they're going to be quite hardwired by evolution, aren't they? Like rotting meat, don't touch it.
Yeah.
You know, off milk, don't touch it.
Mm. I don't know. I just sort of, my gut was telling me that cultural influences were going to be really massive. And actually, they're fairly negligible.
That's much smaller than I thought.
Yeah. Which I think probably tells us what Charles is going to say in answer to our question. Is there a perfect scent? Let's have a listen.
We like some scents more than others. So we might think, you know, the perfect scent is the one that's liked by most people of all. and that might take you down the route of, well, maybe vanilla ought to be the thing. That ought to be the perfect smell, given recent research suggesting that is the smell cross-culturally people liked the most. And yet, probably one also has to bear in mind that, you know, many of our thoughts and feelings and experiences in relation to scent are actually conditioned by experience. So others, you know, might say, well, the perfect scent is the smell of a new car. It makes people feel so good, but it's not in the chemical structure of the scent. It's just because it's associated with a high-value item. So we've learnt that that's such a nice smell. But most of our responses to smell are of that type. And when you put that together with the fact that we are all anosmic, you know, forget COVID for a while, we are all unable to smell some number of scents. For about 1% of the population, maybe it's vanilla they can't smell. I can't smell cork taint in a bottle of wine. We've all got some number of things we can't smell. That means that probably any given scent will not smell the same to all people, nor necessarily be smellable by all people. And so we might need to personalise the answer.
Yeah, you would, which is a bit frustrating.
I mean, I'm glad he didn't say Ling's Java.
Yeah, I would certainly have smelled something there, a rat. or actually, if he said lavender.
Yeah.
I'd be like, oh, come on. So, yeah, I guess vanilla is a decent bet.
Yeah, it is a good one, actually.
Because people across cultures like it, but not everyone does. And so there isn't just a definitive, this is a thing that everyone... Yeah.
So my thing with grass is more emotional than, it's not a shared sort of, you know, human experience.
Probably, yeah, I would guess.
I guess if you cut grass for a living, you're probably not.
Sick of it, yeah. Oh, this again.
Eureka is a Stack production presented by Dr. Michael Brooks and Rick Edwards. The production team is Temi Adebayo, Katie Baxter, Luke Moore and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to today's expert, Professor Charles Spence. Please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a massive difference. We also do really love hearing from you guys, so if you have a burning science question you want answering, drop us an email at eureka@stack.london, or you can find us, as always, on Twitter at EurekaPod. Thanks.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously,
man. Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Anna Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more... And join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.